Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Dr. Kaelin Davenport, lecturer in Roman history from Macquarie University. This is episode LXXXIX, A Man the World Could Not Hold. Determined to end his time as emperor on a high note, Septimius Severus sets his sights on one of the last places in the empire having trouble with the locals, Britannia, an island that has never completely come under Roman rule. Here's Kaelin Davenport. When we're talking about his British campaign, what sources can we look at? What literary sources?
So Cassius Dio, book 77, also Herodian. The Historia Augusta is not very good at all, particularly because it falls into this group of 4th century sources that ascribe the building of Hadrian's Wall, or perhaps the Antonine Wall, we're not quite sure, to Septimius Severus, rather than to Hadrian or Antoninus Pius.
And that's a bit of confusion that lasts for many hundreds of years, isn't it?
Yes, because it's in all these 4th century sources, the Historia Augusta, Eutropius, Aurelius Victor. It's picked up by later authors such as Orosius, also Bede as well. So there's this great tradition that Septimius Severus actually built the wall, not Hadrian or the Antonines. And that would only be sorted out when archaeologists actually uncovered, for example, the building slabs, which actually attributed to the correct emperor.
Yeah. And the other source that we work from this age, from this period, from this event, is the archaeology. So that is a great fountain of knowledge there waiting to be uncovered and that has been examined. And
yes, we wouldn't be able to reconstruct this campaign in such detail without the archaeology, because Cassius Dio and Herodian both fall back on standard literary tropes about barbarians, but from the archaeology we're able to look at renovations that took place on Hadrian's Wall and the surrounding area. Also, we're able to trace the marching camps which Septimius Severus's forces used. Also, we're able to look at the evidence for the major fortresses at Cramond and Carpow in modern-day Scotland.
Yeah. So Septimius Severus sets off in early 208. What is his justification, his reason for going to campaign against Britain? Something must provoke him to want to go there in particular.
Yes, several different reasons have been put forward. Something that appears in the literary sources like Cassius Dio is that he's disappointed with his sons, Antoninus and Geta, and their behaviour. You know, they're going around carousing around town, you know, associating with charioteers, breaking their legs while riding themselves. And he wants to teach them a lesson, you know, take them on campaign to harden them up.
Yeah.
It's also suggested that the legions are becoming enervated with idleness. That's a standard literary trope. You know, Roman legions were pretty good, and there were actually campaigns going on in Britain at this time under a governor, Alfinus Senecio. It's not like they weren't being put through their paces.
But more likely is that Septimius Severus just wanted to get out of Rome, have one last hurrah, and that he was getting a bit restless in the place.
Yes, certainly I think the motivation of glory looms large here, that he wanted to end on a high note. This is certainly Anthony Burley's argument. It's also what Herodian says as well. He's also thought to have been angry that other people were winning wars in his name in Britain while he couldn't control Bulla Felix the Brigand in Italy. So he may have wanted to go to Britain to claim some of that glory for himself. And Cassius Dio also says that Septimius Severus wanted the glory of subjugating all of Britain. The Roman frontier had been extended to the Antonine Wall under Antoninus Pius, but then in the late 150s, early 160s, that had been abandoned. So imagine the kudos that would redound through the generations if you were the emperor who pacified all of Britain.
Yeah.
So essentially, the idea he wants to pacify Caledonia, which is essentially modern-day Scotland, and bring it under Roman control.
And really the last time this had been attempted was when Agricola was in the area. He made progress there, but he didn't make anything lasting.
No. He was recalled by Domitian, allegedly because Domitian was jealous of his success. Again, you know, another senator winning glory when the emperor was back in Rome. So, no, certainly there was no permanent Roman presence in Scotland. There was lots of interaction between the Romans and the tribes north the walls, trade and interaction. And we know that the tribes in Scotland, so the Maetae and the Caledonii, valued Roman coinage and Roman prestige products as well, which have been found from archaeological excavations. So we mustn't see these people as sort of imperviously sealed off from Roman influence.
Well, there is a lot that we know, thanks to Dio, about the people from that time, but we'll get to that in a minute. Can we talk about maybe a bit about his preparations and his journey there? Because that's noted in at least Herodian from memory, that Septimius Severus gets to the coastline of Gaul under a decent amount of speed.
Yes, he goes very fast, even though he's been carried in a litter because of his gout. And there's a big retinue that goes with him. So Julia Domna, his wife, both sons, Antoninus and Geta, one of the Praetorian prefects, Aemilius Papinianus, who is sometimes called Papinian for short. The other Praetorian prefect, Micius Laetus, is staying back in Rome. He's not going back to the Plautianus mistake there.
Yeah.
Also, we have some relatives of Julia Domna who are stationed in Britain at the time. So a man called Verius Marcellus is the equestrian procurator or financial officer of Britain at the time. And he's the husband of Julia Domna's niece, Julia Somias. And then also an equestrian called Iulius Avitus Alexianus is a comes or official companion of the expedition. And he is the husband of Julia Domna's elder sister, Julia Maesa. And these are really key people who are going to play an important role in the later history of the Severan dynasty.
Yeah, right, but yeah.
It's really interesting to see after the downfall of Plautianus, Julia Domna's side of the family, her female relatives and their husbands really starting to play a role here. He probably takes the Equites Singulares Augusti, the Imperial Horse Guard, which was founded by Trajan on the campaign, and probably also some detachments of the Legio II Parthica, which you might remember is that legion he founded stationed at Alba, quite close to Rome.
Yeah.
And there would have been the three legions in Britain, as well as vexillations or detachments from other provinces, probably the German frontier there as well. We're not quite sure how many troops actually went with him in total, but from the supply bases, it may have been about 25,000 that's actually on the expeditionary force that actually goes beyond the wall and invades Scotland.
Before he even gets across to Britain, some people come and attempt to treatise with him, don't they? But he very quickly brushes them off and goes, no, we're going to handle this the hard way.
Yeah, no, they send envoys to try and stop the invasion, but, you know, he wants the glory of a campaign. It's probably that they buy off the Maetae, who's a tribe that lives closest to the Antonine Wall, in order to keep them on side, where they go further into Scotland and take on the Caledonians.
Who were these barbarians to the north? And they were mostly referred to as barbarians in the texts, weren't they?
Yeah, though Cassius Dio does give them names. So there's the Maetae, who live near the Antonine Wall, and the Caledonians, who live further north. Someone like Cassius Dio wouldn't have conducted, you know, much original research.
Yep.
Certainly the ethnographic description which we have of these tribes relies on common literary tropes, which we find in earlier writers, Tacitus, but also going back to the Greek tradition as well there.
Yeah. As far as the word barbarians, that was used quite extensively across the empire. I remember it was used in the Marco-Manica Wars to describe the enemies in that war as well.
Yes. It's a conventional term for foreigners who are uncivilized.
Yes.
Essentially.
But you get a nice bit of ethnography in Dio, and I'd like to pick through that if we can.
Yeah.
But also, it comes up in Herodian as well, but he would have been relying on what Dio wrote.
Yeah, I mean, Herodian may have been relying on Dio, but not necessarily, because these are fairly standard tropes, so he wouldn't have needed to read Dio in order to come up with this. He would have just been educated in this Greco-Roman tradition of how you describe barbarians as other or different from, you know, civilized Romans who have nice villas with hypocausts and, you know, aqueducts and things like that.
So what does Dio then tell us about the Caledonians and the enemies that Septimius Severus is going to come up against?
Well, certainly they're the antithesis of Rome. They live in a swampy, marshy land. And this is in Cassius Dio, Book 77, Chapter 12, Dio says, they dwell in tents, naked and unshod, possess their women in common, and in common rear all the offspring. So it's a bit like some sort of hippie commune or something like that. There's no sort of family unit and they're all naked and, you know, the antithesis of what Rome is. Dio goes on to say their form of rule is democratic for the most part, and they are very fond of plundering. Consequently, they choose their boldest men as rulers. They go into battle in chariots and have small, swift horses. There are also foot soldiers, very swift in running and very firm in standing their ground. For arms, they have a shield and a short spear, with a bronze apple attached to the end of the spear shaft, so that when it's shaken, it may clash and terrify the enemy. And they also have daggers. This great image of people who are on horseback, they run around, and they create a lot of noise. That's a way that you might try and get a tactical advantage over the Romans in their discipline and order. We know that tribes, you know, if they're more nimble and quick on their foot, could actually cause damage to the Roman legions.
Mm. You also get a very much a perception of a marshy terrain and something that the Romans would struggle to operate in.
It's not a nice, flat battlefield that they're engaging with here. Dio says they can endure hunger and cold and any kind of hardship, for they plunge into their swamps and exist there for many days with only their heads above water. And in the forest, they support themselves upon bark and roots. And for all the emergencies, they prepare a certain kind of food, the eating of a small portion of which, the size of a bean, prevents them from feeling either hunger or thirst. I have no idea what that is, by the way. But the idea of these sort of swamp people that just stand in the swamp with their heads above water for days, it's kind of a terrifying image, which I think would appeal to Dio's readers.
It sounds very mythical. It sounds like these are otherworldly people that the emperor is going away to fight.
Yeah, and you think of these stories that probably were passed on. You know, did you hear this? Did you hear that? I saw them do this. They grow even more extravagant as they are passed around.
Mm. What details does Herodian add to this?
So Herodian tells us that they tattoo their bodies with lots of designs and drawings of animals. And he also says they're naked because that would cover up their tattoos.
Oh, so keep your tattoos on display.
Yes. Which, you know, again, is also plausible, but this would be quite shocking to the Roman military disciplines.
Marshes and magic beans aside, how accurate is this when we want to talk about the Caledonian scene?
Look, this really does rely on a lot of literary tropes. The idea of the barbarian as naked and wild and undisciplined. We know from the archaeological evidence that there was considerable interaction between Romans and the Caledonians, that they valued Roman prestige goods, and that it's not this sort of unorganized, unhierarchical society. That the leaders of these tribes gain prestige because of their relations with Rome and the Roman goods that they had as well there. So Dio and Herodian are drawing a very stark them and us characterization.
Let's talk about the campaign itself then. Septimius Severus takes his troops across to Britannia. There's troops as well that he can put in use there. Where's his headquarters of war?
His headquarters is at York in the northern end of the province.
What's it called then?
It's called Eboracum in Latin. So it's where the Legio VI Victrix is based there as well. And it's within striking distance of Hadrian's Wall and the forts there.
Okay, so you can pretty much sit there and look out and go, right, that's what we need to aim for. So how does it unfold?
Yes, so we know from the archaeological evidence that there's considerable repairs and improvements made to Corbridge and South Shields on Hadrian's Wall, particularly in order to secure the military supply lines. It's thought that these could provide food for 25,000 soldiers for a six-month campaign. So that's probably a plausible size for the campaigning force. Cassius Dio talks about 50,000 Roman soldiers dying in a single incident, but that's clearly exaggerated, as so many of these military figures are.
So he leaves Geta behind there in York. I'm going to call it York.
Geta stays behind in York. And actually, the next year in 209, he actually gets the promotion to Augustus, which no doubt is long sought after. He's probably left there to be the imperial representative in the field of government there.
Yeah.
Whereas Severus and Antoninus actually go out on campaign beginning in 209 against the Caledonians. They've got the Maitai on side by buying them off as a key strategy with barbarians. And we know roughly the route that the expeditionary force would have taken because of archaeological evidence for the temporary marching camps that were erected by the force on their way up. The first group leads up to the fort at Cramond on the Firth of Forth. And there's another lot of camps which lead up to the fort at Carpow on the Tay. And then there's another row which leads diagonally into the northeast to the Mounth, which is a hilly area on the northeastern coast of Scotland.
Yeah, okay.
So we know from the archaeological evidence that that's the way Septimius Severus went. It used to be thought that he may have headed up more to the northwest to the Moray Firth, but the camps leading up there are probably Flavian in date, so they're probably dating from Agricola's campaigns.
Mm.
So we know Septimius Severus is heading to the northeast, and the fortress at Carpow was constructed by the Legio VI Victrix. We know that from the tile stamps in the area.
How were the Roman troops coping with the terrain and the enemy that they were coming across?
Well, not very well, according to Cassius Dio. They didn't like the marshy terrain. Cassius Dio talks about 50,000 troops being slain to avoid capture by the barbarians.
This is essentially marching till they were exhausted and then killing your own troops because they're falling down and can't go any further. This isn't about enemy interaction or anything like that. This is simply down to we can't handle the terrain.
They couldn't go on any further.
Yeah.
Now, of course, Dio's figures are exaggerated here.
Yeah.
The force itself was probably about 25,000.
Somebody added an extra C and an M and an L somewhere in the translation.
well, also because they like nice big round figures to shock people. Whatever the truth of the numbers, it's clear that they found it a difficult campaign. We know that they would have had to cross these firths in Scotland. There's a medallion of Antoninus minted in 209, which actually shows a bridge of boats. So they probably used this to try and cross one of the firths, probably beyond the fortress of Carpow. And Dio says that Septimius Severus didn't stop until he had reached the furthest limit of the island.
Yeah.
Now, this isn't the north coast of Scotland. It's probably the area known as the Mounth on the northeastern coast there. Cassius Dio says Septimius himself was carried on a litter. So he got a nice march through Scotland, unlike his troops. But because of this inroads into the Caledonian territory, they were forced to make peace. So there was no great big pitched battle or anything like that that's recorded in any of our literary sources. The Caledonians had to sign a peace treaty that they would surrender no small part of their territory, according to Dio.
Mm.
We're not really sure what this was. It may have been the area Septimius Severus marched through. Certainly, the indications are with the stone fortifications at Carpow that they intended that to be a permanent base in Scotland.
Yeah, yeah. So were they meeting any resistance of any sort? We don't really get records of a big pitched battle or anything like that, but surely there must have been exchange of sword rattling in some aspect.
Yes, Cassius Dio says that although Septimius Severus fought no battle, the enemy purposely put sheep and cattle in front of the soldiers for them to seize in order that they might be lured on still further until they were worn out. So it's sort of like this guerrilla warfare there that, you know, oh, look at the cattle, let's run there to get the Caledonians, when it was really just trying to exhaust them. But Septimius Severus claimed it was a great victory. So after this treaty with the Caledonians early in 210, all emperors, that's Septimius Severus, Antoninus and now Geta, assumed the title Britannicus Maximus, the greatest conqueror of Britain, was now added to all their extravagant victory title.
Added some territory.
When you extend the boundaries of the Roman Empire, you get to claim a new victory title.
All right, so now we're at a brief lull between campaigns, if I can call it that.
Yeah.
And already what Dio is focusing on is the trouble that Antoninus is causing. And so a bit of foreshadowing here, essentially.
Definitely. And there does seem to be real tension between Septimius Severus and Antoninus. You know, he may be chafing at the bit to get his turn as sole emperor. We get stories about him wanting to kill Geta if he ever got the chance. He has an argument with the freedman Castor, one of the imperial secretaries who's accompanying on the campaign. But The greatest problem is when Septimius Severus and Antoninus ride together to meet the enemy in order to agree on a truce with the army behind them. Antoninus then pulls out his sword as if to kill Septimius Severus. The Romans, you know, start to shout to warn Septimius Severus. Septimius Severus then calls Antoninus to his tent, together with the freedman Castor and the Praetorian prefect Papinian, and challenges Antoninus to kill him there and then if he wants to become emperor. It's really interesting here what Cassius Dio says, that despite the fact he knew that this was going on, he never did anything to harm Antoninus or to disinherit him in any way, despite the fact that Septimius Severus is supposed to have criticized Marcus Aurelius for not getting rid of Commodus.
It's a really kind of interesting story, that little interaction, and can I say hard to believe? Because if you're riding out with a bunch of Roman troops behind you and you pull out your sword to kill your father then... I can't imagine it going well for you with that many witnesses in front of the Caledonians, losing face in front of the enemy.
Yeah.
It seems rather far-fetched.
Yeah, it's difficult to know to what extent these sources are just repeating stories that emerge later when Antoninus is sole emperor. It's a common rumour throughout Roman history that sons want to get rid of their fathers to succeed. So it does actually fit into that kind of popular belief that heirs are always chafing at the bit to get rid of their fathers.
Yeah, but there's a time and a place, you know?
Yeah, no, exactly. But you can sort of understand how these rumours might start. I mean, Cassius Dio even has dialogue here. Could be his own invention. But it could reflect a reality of tension in the Severan camp here. You have an emperor who's obviously dying, is very ill, he's on the way out, and people are planning for what's going to happen afterwards. So I think we can see these stories as reflections of that tension and anxiety within the regime.
So the peace that has been worked out doesn't really last long. We quickly get the start of what's called the second campaign in this war. So was there a specific event or a specific incursion or something like that that happened at this point?
We know much less about this second campaign. We do know that there were revolts both by the Maetae and the Caledonians, which really annoys Septimius Severus, understandably. Cassius Dio, 77.15, has a great quotation which Septimius Severus is said to have proclaimed, taken from Homer's Iliad. "Let no one escape sheer destruction. No one our hands, not even the babe in the womb of the mother, if it be male, let it nevertheless not escape sheer destruction." So, you know, he wants to put down this revolt in no uncertain terms. Once again, he seemed indicating that he's thinking about more permanent occupation of some of these lands.
But this is beyond that. This isn't just putting down revolt. This is, you had your chance, now it's genocide.
Yeah. Take no prisoners approach. Yeah. And Septimius Severus starts to make preparations, but conduct of the campaign is actually entrusted to Antoninus instead.
So his health is at that much of a point where he's staying behind in York.
Yes, exactly. Now, according to Herodian, Antoninus was more interested in carrying favour with the troops than in actually conducting a campaign. Again, information is thin on the ground. We do know from inscriptions that some of the Maetae and the Caledonians were forced to serve as troops in the Roman armies afterwards. So there seems to have been some kind of penalty inflicted on them. But then Septimius Severus's death overtook all of these events.
Antoninus is out on the campaign at this point, and Septimius Severus passes away back in York.
Back in York, yes. So this is on the 4th of February 211 at York. There are rumours once again that Antoninus hurried his demise.
Bribed the doctors, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, again, you know, Commodus is thought to have done the same thing.
True.
But before he died, he's reported to have spoken to both Antoninus and Geta, and these are the most famous words ever attributed to Septimius Severus, when he is said to have said, "Be harmonious, enrich the soldiers, and scorn all other men." This is often taken as a byword for the Severan regime, and is certainly I think, blown out of proportion by later writers when they talk about the Severan military monarchy, which I think we'll talk about a bit in a moment when we look at the assessment of his regime. But it's not his last words. This is what he's supposed to have said to his sons when he was dying.
And two out of three ain't bad. Not harmonious.
Yeah, not harmonious, yeah.
Enrich the soldiers.
And score another man.
Yeah, sure.
Apparently, his last words is that, you know, when he was dying, he said, "Come, give it here if we have anything to do." So he's a man who was working to the last. I think that recalls Vespasian's last lines that, you know, an emperor ought to die on his feet. So he's cremated and his ashes are interned in the mausoleum of Hadrian in Rome, in this Antonine dynastic mausoleum, which, yes, I think is rather fitting given his ambitions there.
Read out the purple urn line.
Oh, yes. Dio said that Septimius Severus sent for a purple urn shortly before his death, and after feeling it, remarked, "Thou shalt hold a man that the world could not hold."
Nice. Got a very big opinion of himself.
Yes, yes.
But that being said, that Dio would maybe agree with it.
Yeah, he was certainly a larger-than-life figure. I mean, Cassius Dio is someone who had lived through the ups and downs of the Severan regime. You know, Septimius Severus was a man who managed to defeat three other rivals for the purple: Didius Julianus, Clodius Albinus, Pascennius Niger. You know, he waged, you know, two campaigns against Parthia, a campaign in Britain, and most successful of all, he died of natural causes.
Yes.
No one murdered him,
yeah.
Which I think is a stunning success for a Roman emperor, especially in the 3rd century. You know, he also founded a new dynasty, one that, you know, looked back to and drew on the Antonines, as well as, you know, would continue on into the future as well.
So he is well-remembered contemporarily, it's fair to say, isn't it? Things could have gone a lot worse coming out of the Civil War.
He's known as a harsh taskmaster, and Cassius Dio ultimately has a mixed opinion of him, but he was definitely, I would say, the most successful of the Severan emperors. You know, when we think that he had to come to power with these civil wars, and yes, he put a lot of senators to death, but that was something he had to do in order to secure his position. He also had a number of senatorial and equestrian supporters who were right behind him from the beginning. Mm. Very often these were new men whose career really made the fortunes of their family, and their descendants would continue to be senators for generations after that as well.
Yeah. How has he fared in modern scholarship as you come through the ages and you get a bit reflective and you've got a lot of hindsight as well? How does Septimius Severus stack up there?
He used to be thought that the Severan period is part of this decline of Rome, which happens, you know, after Commodus. People used to talk of the Severan military monarchy. The naked ambition of the emperors and the army was finally laid bare, and that it might, you know, lead to the eventual decline of Rome. That is very much overstated, if only because the empire continues for another couple of centuries and actually recovers from a number of military crises.
Mm.
If we look at what Septimius Severus achieved with the army, he did change some things and introduce some important innovations. For example, when he discharged the Praetorians and stopped recruiting them exclusively from Italy and instead recruiting people from all over the legions. This actually provided a new sort of elite career pathway for soldiers who might want the opportunity for greater prestige in serving the Praetorian Guard, even if they were from Germany or the Danubian region,
yeah.
For example. He also gave the soldiers privileges such as the right to form associations, which they hadn't been allowed to do before. It used to be thought that he lifted the ban on marriage, but Professor Werner Eck from the University of Cologne has conclusively disproved that with the publication of a military diploma, showing that Septimius Severus probably gave them the right to cohabit with women, probably outside the camps, but he didn't lift the ban on marriage of soldiers during service. A lot of his sort of tactical innovations would become increasingly important throughout the 3rd century. For example, the creation of this Legio II Parthica, which was stationed at Albanum near Rome. This would become the core of strategic field army led by the emperors throughout the 3rd century. And increasingly what we find smaller tactical units called vexillations attached to larger expeditionary forces. And all this was actually, it's not evidence of a declining military monarchy. It's actually evidence of strategic innovation there as well.
Yeah.
Septimius Severus did increase army pay, for example, and he's often been blamed for that, for causing inflation in the 3rd century. But the army hadn't received a pay rise since the reign of Domitian. That's over a century ago.
Yeah.
You know, that's totally unjustified. What actually happens then is that Antoninus increases military pay again, and then a couple of decades later, Maximinus Thrax does. So that's when the real problems start to set in.
Mm.
Septimius Severus is cultivating his relationship with the troops, but not to the exclusion of senators.
Yeah. So perhaps then his biggest failing is he's the father of Antoninus. Hasn't learned from the mistakes, quotation fingers, of Marcus Aurelius. I mean, I know it's a really hard thing to do, not to support your child no matter what sort of character they have. Mm. But you'd think that he would have looked to the past and what happened there, and maybe put some sort of contingency plan in place. And I suppose the only one that he could do there was to make Geta co-Augustus just before he died.
Mm. Yeah, the idea that the two of them would rule together and hopefully balance each other out, perhaps on the model of Marcus Aurelius and Lucius Verus. In Rome, the dynastic principle was always going to win out. Yes, for political purposes, this idea of, you know, choosing the best man sort of came in importance in the end of the 1st century to justify a selection of Nerva and then Trajan. But really, the dynastic principle would always win out, and that was the person who was going to succeed you. So he did try and put plans in place by having this sort of joint rule between Antoninus and Geta, and also the fact that they had been Augustus and Caesar and been on campaigns. He was trying to prepare them for the business of ruling the empire.
Gibbon starts his decline and fall of the Roman Empire with the reign of Commodus, so he's very much tagging this period down as being part of the fall.
Yes.
So would you agree with that assessment then? Would you think that the five good emperors maybe deserves a bit of a footnote afterwards to say, hey, look, the Severan dynasty wasn't all bad. This is actually quite a good emperor by Rome standards.
Yeah, I wouldn't agree with Gibbon at all. This is the old paradigm when, you know, everything past Marcus Aurelius is falling into decay. But it's an awful long period of decay if we're extending all the way to the mid to late 5th century. And then, of course, the Eastern Roman Empire, which continues as well. And yes, you know, there are problems in the 3rd century, there's a period of crisis, but then you get great emperors like Diocletian and Constantine, for example, as well. So Septimius Severus isn't continuing this tradition of decline. You know, he's a cunning general, you know, a good political strategist, and he actually sets the path that actually helped the Roman Empire survive the crises of the 3rd century.
And when he came into power, it seems like there was a big sigh of relief in Rome that he's somebody decent, and he does have quite a long rule for the time and does do right by Rome, a few senators aside.
Yes, you know, he introduces stability. And that's one thing people want in the Roman Empire. They don't want civil war. They want peace and stability. This is the whole idea of how, you know, the empire came into being as well. People wanted Augustus to be sole ruler because he would end the traumas of civil war. So if you have a dynasty, if you have someone like Septimius Severus with two sons who are going to continue on his rule, if you're going to have someone who invests in building projects, if you have someone who's going to pay the soldiers more, then this is, you know, a kind of emperor that Rome actually needs.
That's Dr. Kaelin Davenport, lecturer in Roman history at Macquarie University. And you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, please consider subscribing to it in Apple Podcasts or your local friendly neighbourhood podcatching service. You can like the Emperors of Rome Facebook page, and you can follow both myself and Kaelin on Twitter. Kaelin is at Dr. C. Davenport, and I am at Nightlight Guy. In the next episode of Emperors of Rome, we take an interlude to learn about one of the greatest sophists in Rome before we take a break from emperors and take the story back to the fall of the Roman Republic. But until then, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.